Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mincer.
I want to welcome everybody to today's program, Exploring Spiritual Opportunities in the Second Half of Life. And I'm delighted that Bob Weber is going to be our guest today. I'm Dori Mincer, owner of Revolutionize Retirement. Without further ado, since I know we have a wonderful program ahead of us, I just want to introduce Bob Weber, who is a clinical psychologist at Harvard University. And I think we're going to learn about Bob from him. I'm not going to go more into telling you about him because I think he's going to help us learn about himself. And he's going to be really focusing on where do we come from, what are we, and where are we going. Bob, I'm going to turn it over to you, and I really want to start with asking you a little about what life experiences led to your arrival at today's subject.
Okay, let me comment on that, but first, where the three questions you just posed come from. About a week and a half ago, I was at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and whenever I'm there, I make it a point to go and see certain works of art, particularly certain paintings. And one of my favorites is by Paul Gauguin, who, you may know, left France and moved to Tahiti to really search for his life. And Gauguin called this particular painting I love, I think, his masterpiece, the pinnacle of his career. And in French, it's D'où venons-nous? Que sommes-nous? Où allons-nous? Those of you who speak French, we're in different time zones here, I know. Maybe we're even in different countries. I have no idea. But the translation is what Dori said. Where do we come from? What are we? And where are we going? In a sense, that is what spirituality is about. It is a way, a path, an opportunity to answer some of those important questions, which are part of our lives. Maybe particularly part of our lives as we get older. They become a bit more pressing. So perhaps some of you are on this call because you're thinking, I'm getting older, or that is, if you're willing to admit it, because age denial is quite prevalent in our society. And I think spirituality is one way to really not just adapt to it, but to affirm it. Aging is a way to really affirm life and not just adapt. It's an opportunity, one that can deepen how you live life. Some of you may be on this call for professional reasons. Dori and I are a member of an organization called Life Planning Network, and it consists of professionals who are working with essentially the 50-plus group or the baby boomer plus group. And what we do is we offer our particular skills, training, expertise to people. It may be financial management. It may have to do with housing or healthcare or physical exercise. If you look at the Life Planning Network sphere, there are 10 dimensions. And one of those dimensions is spirituality. Perhaps it gets shorter shrift than the others. It is nonetheless as important as any of the others, and I've brought some of my thinking to an LPN meeting here in the Boston area, and in effect doing that today with all of you. So you may be here for professional reasons. You may be here for just personal reasons. I'm involved in the aging issue for a combination of personal and professional issues. Perhaps the way to get you familiar with what I mean is to give you a sense of the what I call the trajectory of my life. It, in a sense, it's answering the first question of Paul Gauguin. D'où venons-nous? The singular would be, d'où est-ce que je viens? Where do I come from? So let me tell you where I come from to this topic. I'm going to break it down into three sectors. From 0 to 30 years old, from 30 years old to 60 years old, and from 60 plus, thirds of life. Life is often spoken of that way. We're talking about this as the second half of life, but that's okay, because 50 plus, we could consider the second half. The first 30 years, I would say, beside trying to achieve all the things a kid tries to achieve going through high school, grade school, high school, college, and on, spirituality and religion, not just spirituality, but spirituality and religion played a big part in my life. I grew up in a small town in New Jersey, and Roman Catholicism was my religion. I was born into it. I didn't choose it. I was born into it. Fortunately, I had really good mentoring by priests, by sisters, and by my own family, such that not only did religion become important to me, but spirituality. I can remember vividly mornings when I would go to Mass early as a kid, by choice, and or because I was an altar boy. Those of you who are Catholic know what that means. You assist the person presiding at the Mass. And I would have this profound sense of peace and calm and comfort. Not articulatable in words, ineffable in effect, and I would just be there. Spirituality is about learning how just to be there. So I was getting an early lesson in that. Now, if that image makes you think that all was well, it certainly wasn't. Because to give you another growth point in my life, at age 7, I was watching an old show, and I discovered in watching it that they were holding a funeral for Gramps. Now, the old show was Lassie. Those of you who are old, as old as I am, 66, will perhaps remember this particular episode. The actor in real life, George Cleveland, had died. And they phased out the series by running this episode that had already been recorded and then added Gramps' funeral. I became terrified. I was sitting in the living room, small living room in a small two-family house with my parents and my younger sister, and I was terrified, but I went mute. Over the next 2 weeks, I hung around the house. I didn't go out. I lived in dread. My mother noticed. She said, "What's wrong, Bobby?" I said, "Nothing. Tough little boy." The town I grew in, you had to be a tough little boy. But this persisted, and she too was persistent. And finally, she got me to sit down one day, and she said, "Tell me what's bothering you. You aren't going out to play with your friends." I was depressed. I didn't tell her that because I didn't know. I'd had to become a psychologist to know what the diagnosis of depression was. But I burst into tears. I sobbed and sobbed. I looked at her, and I said, "You're going to die. You're going to die." My mother put her hand on my shoulder. She wasn't a big hugger, but she touched me and she looked at me and she said, "Get this, that's true. I am going to die someday." And I went, "Oh, I'm right." Then she added, "But probably not for a while." And indeed, that was the case. She died, that would have been 53, so roughly 39 years later, and I was 46. But she added, and this was the part that I carry with me, she said, "So in the meantime, why don't you go out and play with your friends? And that's what I've been doing ever since. Now, at this age, of course, my own death is closer. And you know what? I don't have the terror and dread I had when I was 7. And I am living, which is what I hope this time together today will encourage in each of you. Third piece of that first 30 years was my being really fulfilling, I think, what at that point was a Catholic family's greatest wish for their son to become a priest. Now, I chose to become a Jesuit. I was in training to become a priest. A priest was, in a sense, that than which nothing greater could be conceived. But I spent 10 years as a Jesuit and then realized that something wasn't right, that I wasn't living fully. Fortunately, the Jesuit community was very encouraging of my continued growth. That took me beyond the Jesuit community into a new life, ultimately as a married man. From 0 to 30 was largely dominated by the spiritual part. And that was very important to me. 30 to 60, I would say, is more dominated by mental health. Now, I'm mentioning these because I have been working to weave together spirituality and mental health and aging. The second stage was, in a sense, living out mental health. I became a psychologist, trained in psychodynamic approaches. I was not, nor ever have been, a psychoanalyst, but I used many of the techniques, trained in group therapy, and essentially lived as a psychologist professionally for about 30 years. And spirituality and religion, while I continued to have them as important in my life, were not integrated into my professional work. Now, when I got to my mid-50s, or maybe when I was 50 and got my invitation to join AARP, I realized that something was shifting. I was getting older, and I know it even better now. I'm on Medicare. I'm also just received my first Social Security benefits. So I am getting older. But what's interesting and what's happened since is that there has been a reemergence of spirituality in a new way. And I have been actively working to integrate mental health, spirituality, and aging. That has been essential for me. It's the three strands of my life. Interestingly enough, in German, my name, Weber, translates as the weaver. I guess I'm living up to my name, trying to weave together these three different dimensions. Happily.
It's lovely to hear your journey, Bob. Just the weaving together, as you say, but also I'm so impressed with just your mother's capacity to own the reality of mortality and yet give you permission to live life fully. It just is such a wonderful message, and one would wish that more and more parents are able to convey that to their children, because it sounds like it's enabled you to spend your life both working and playing. As Freud said, it's love and work, and it sounds like you've been really working on integrating both. Before we shift a little to the present, and you may want to add anything more there too, I just want to say nobody's submitted any questions yet, so please just know that on the Instant Teleseminar site, that's where you can use that little chat feature and just send any comments or questions so that I can integrate those into some of the responses that Bob has.
Let me interject something here, Dory, apropos of your comment. Mm-hmm. Questions. Whether or not you choose to submit one, everybody listening in has questions. Big questions, little questions. And questions are pivotal. When people come to see me as a psychologist, I often say, how do you hope I can be of use to you? And they say, not untypically, I've come for answers. And I look at them and I say, you know what? I'm probably not the person for you to work with. And they look at me, because I consider myself a true expert. I don't say this to them, but I'm saying it to myself. A true expert in my mind is someone who knows or she knows what he does not know and is willing to admit it. I tell them instead what I can offer you and how I might be of use to you is to help you to ask more refined and better questions of yourself so that you can then answer them and we can work collaboratively on your answering the questions for yourself in ways that are going to make them yours, be meaningful to you, and therefore more functional in your life. As the poet Rilke said in his wonderful book, Letters to a Young Poet, a man had written to him and said, Rilke, should I be a poet? And Rilke said, how the heck do I know? Not exactly the way he put it. He put it in poetic language. But what he said to the man is said, do not now seek answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. I would hope that today, in hearing about me and my work, would also evoke and provoke the questions that may lay buried in you, so that you might begin to think a little bit more about them, to make them become more rich and more full for yourself.
That Rilke poem is beautiful. There is actually, I actually have a couple of questions, but one that I think fits very much into what you're talking about now, Bob, and also given what a life and background you had, which was seeped in kind of religion. A question from Sally, who's in Brookline, says, if you're not naturally spiritual, how do you begin? How does one, if it's not been part of your past, how do you begin?
I would say, Sally, that you've already begun. You're already listening to yourself. One of the things I hope during this interaction today, it's a rather strange interaction since I can't see anybody and you can't see me, but is that you listen and you are listening to yourself. Let me say four steps. Approach what we're doing here today in four steps. First, listen to what's being said by me or asked by Dory. Listen to what it stirs up in you. Listen to what's there. But then don't just listen, because often when we're listening, we're already starting to fashion our answer without really hearing the other person or, indeed, hearing ourselves. First listen, then hear. Truly hear what that question, what your question says to you, Sally. How do I get started? I'm not really spiritual by nature. I think my sense of people when they come to me is we're working on four dimensions anyway. Body, mind, heart, and spirit. Something that sort of suffuses our whole being. Whatever, however you envision what spirit means, it's life force. It's life force. Well, you can see it as derived from God, or you can see it as just this is the way the world is. There's life in the world. So you're already acting spiritually. I don't want to force you into a mold you may not want to be forced into. Perhaps it would be more of a mold to force you into if I said, you're being religious. Most people eschew that more than anything. There are a lot of what are called SBNRs out there, spiritual but not religious. And then there are NSNRs, not spiritual, not religious. And then there's me, RS, religious and spiritual. I don't know if that responds to your question, Sally, but that's what comes to mind.
I'm going to hold off on the others till a little bit later, because I'd like you to, if you would, Bob, tell us a little more about now in the present. How would you describe your work and your approach to it? I think you've begun doing that, but I just thought it would be helpful if maybe you could share a little more of that.
Mm-hmm. My work is predominantly working as a psychotherapist and a psychologist. I teach, I consult, I supervise, I run groups. I have a psycho-spiritual issues group that I run. I run interpersonal therapy groups. And what I have been working to do in those groups, remember, psychology has for many years not been the friend to anything related to religion or spirituality. Freud wrote his classic, The Future of an Illusion, and that left a big imprint on the profession. What is very interesting, though, and this is apart from books on New Age or New Age spirituality, there has been a burgeoning interest in spirituality and religion insofar as it's related to psychology and professional psychological practice. Believe it or not, the American Psychological Association has approximately 10 books now, tomes, published on psychology and spirituality and or religion. Freud is probably rolling over in his grave. But that's the truth. That's what's happening. For years, I was closeted insofar as I think the importance of my spirituality and religion, and I still get ribbed about it by people, colleagues. However, it is, I think, relevant. So one of the things, Dori, that I've been doing is thinking a lot about how are spirituality, specifically, less so religion, spirituality, related to psychology. And I see them as much more congruent or convergent than divergent. What I've been discovering in having studied the different psychodynamic or psychoanalytic models is that many of the dynamics that are described are also very much prevalent in the spiritual literature. Probably the first psychologists, in fact, were old-time desert fathers and mothers and spiritual directors from way back in the 3rd, 4th century AD. So we are, in a sense, returning to some of the original roots where this divergence took place.
So interesting. But how, can you explain a little, what is the difference between spirituality, as you're describing it, and religion?
Okay, a very important question, especially since SBNR tends to be more prevalent than RS. I would say, and again, with good reason, let me say, I think many people have been burned by their religious experience, hurt by it. Many have not. For me, I've not been. Oh, there are aspects, like Catholic confessionals. But I have not been. But religion is, to put it in simple terms, a more or less organized search for the spiritual associated with a covenant faith community and narratives that enhance the search for the sacred. Put another way, religion tends to address or articulate the following: a problem. It also tries to articulate a solution to this problem, which serves as a religious goal. It suggests techniques for moving through the problem to the solution. And it often provides exemplars who chart this path from problem to solution. So religion is in a sense, has a certain formula to it. Much more than that, I think, but let's go with that for the time being. For example, let's take Christianity, which is my religion. At least one of the problems, or the problem, let's say, is sin. The solution is salvation. The technique for achieving salvation is some combination of faith and good works. And the exemplars who chart this path are the saints in Roman Catholicism and Orthodoxy, and ordinary people of faith in Protestantism. Now, Buddhism. Now, Buddhism, technically, I wouldn't call it a religion, but let's envision it a bit that way for the moment. So my apologies to any of you who is a Buddhist and would say, boy, that's wrong. But let's say the problem in Buddhism is suffering. The solution is seeking nirvana. The technique for achieving nirvana is the Noble Eightfold Path, which includes such classic Buddhist practices as meditation and chanting. And the exemplars who chart this path are arhats in Theravada Buddhism, bodhisattvas in Mahayana Buddhism, or lamas in Vajrayana Buddhism. So religion can be, I think, conceptualized that way. Now, spirituality. Spirituality, in overarching terms, I think, encompasses a search for meaning. You know, what's the point? What's the point? What's the point of life? What's the point of death? What's the point of suffering? What's the point of love? What's the, you name it. It also encompasses a search for unity and for connectedness. It tends toward a search for the transcendent, that which goes beyond the concrete, the finite. And it's also, I guess we can use Maslow's term, the highest search for the highest of human potential. I'm going to say a little more about spirituality in a moment and specify another model of it, which I want to elaborate because I think it will hopefully be useful to people. One of the things I hoped is to give a sense of how we can use spirituality if you're so inclined, whether you think you're not naturally spiritual. You could still use this method because, again, it has strong resonance with good psychology, this particular model I'm going to put out there. I don't know, Dory, did you want to bounce
off that? What you're saying makes so much sense and also clarifies the importance as we get older, because there's such a shift of really trying to say, is this all there is and what's it all about? And I'm just thinking as health changes, actually there are two questions that might be apropos now, although as you talk and propose this next model, it may speak to it. But let me just ask you these questions to maybe integrate into your talking. Another question from Sally, who's in Brookline, of just wondering if you ever use spirituality with family caregivers. And in a similar vein, although a somewhat slightly different question, but from Carrie, who's in San Francisco, wonders what are your thoughts on strategies for coping with loss in relationships, and how, with your framework and your approach, do you help people cope with the loss of relationships?
Mm-hmm. Let me pick up on that one because it'll get to a piece of what I want to talk about model-wise. I think one of my favorite quotes is by a Spaniard who said, love is the child of illusion and the parent of disillusion. Love is the child of illusion and the parent of disillusion. We all come to life, to relationships, to our professions with certain idealized, illusory, idealized conceptions about the way it will be. And indeed, it's not all bad. Falling head over heels in love with somebody and desiring to form a relationship is a very good thing. The critical point, though, is when the disillusionment occurs. Like when my wife says to me, would you please put your shoes away? Or I say to her, put the toilet paper on under, not over. I've got my little quirks and eccentricities. And that can start the disillusionment. There could be greater cases or causes for the disillusionment. But at that point, the work really begins. That's when a couple, or any relationship, parent, child, couple, people in love, friends, that's often when the real relationship, the real connectedness starts, is when you have to grapple with things not being the way you wish they would be. And let's face it, life isn't the way we wish it would be, more often than not. But it is also the way we would hope it would be often. I don't know if that addresses person from San
Francisco. I don't know for sure if it addresses the person from San Francisco. Maybe she can come back with another question if there's more, but it's certainly a lot of food for thought of thinking about the kind of the meat of relationships, and it's the disconnect that actually leads to further connection.
Yeah, let me jump on, pick up on Sally's question too about would I bring up spirituality with family caregivers? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've been doing work in the field of gerontology now for about the last 10 years, and I've done some consulting at times to groups. I was with a group that does a lot of work. It's a healthcare system, and I've worked with some of their staff in thinking about how to conceptualize and make more, put into practice spirituality. And this particular healthcare system is, interestingly enough, also, to begin with, religiously oriented. And yet they're grappling with, how do we do spirituality? Mm-hmm. So I think no matter where you are on the continuum, there's room. I think we as professionals need to open the doors wide for people. We need to let them bring to us what they want. Interestingly enough, as a psychologist, most people walk into my office and don't think that religious or spiritual discussions are fair game, unless they've gone to my website and seen contemplating, which is on the handout. Then they get a sense of who I am. Then it becomes okay. Then we can talk about it. But I take a more active stance in regard to that. I want to put out there that it is fair game for us to talk about spirituality. So for those of you whose questions center on professional issues, I can actually send you. What I'd like to do is, if you look at the recommended readings, you'll see three things by me, two of which are out already, one of which is in process, a book. But one of those is about becoming a spiritually informed group leader. I was interested in it, so I wanted to put that out there for my colleagues. And there are five steps, and I think these steps can be applied to professionals. Substitute whatever your family caregiver instead of group. First, be clear about your own spiritual orientation and its importance. Be clear about your own spiritual orientation and its importance. Look at where you've come from. Do you detest spirituality? Do you embrace it whole hog? What about religion? Where does that fall? Know where you stand so that you don't preclude someone from bringing that in. Second, be clear about your definition of spirituality and religion. Again, I'm trying to give you a sense of ways to think about spirituality and religion. Step three, be clear about your understanding of the interrelationship between the spiritual and the dimensions of your work that are relevant. So for me, it's psychodynamic. It's psychotherapeutic. Family caregiver, it'll be very different things, perhaps. Fourth, make explicit that you welcome the spiritual dimension into the group process. Now, how to do that? I do that right from the get-go. So in my intake, after I've gotten to know a person a bit, I say, I'd like to tell you a little bit about how we can work together. Let me tell you this. And I point to a table on which stands my clock. Actually, clocks. Therapists have to have multiple clocks. So I have two there, one up above. I'm the timekeeper. And so I say, there are four legs on that table. And on that table are my clocks. Now, envision that as the table of life, and there are four legs on it for you as well. Your table of life. And they look at me and I say, the first leg, and this goes back to what you said in the beginning, Dory, about Sigmund Freud and his notion of Leben und Arbeit, and love and work. The first leg is love. It has to do with affection, love, connection, relationship. The second leg is work. What you do with your talents, your skills, your abilities, those two things are welcome in the therapeutic process. The third leg is play. How do you spend your leisure time? How do you recreate, rejuvenate yourself? We can talk about that too. Everybody thinks that therapy, or not everybody, but most people that I've met coming in as clients or patients, think about therapy as it's work. If it don't hurt, it ain't good. Yes, that all needs to be addressed, but also bring in what gives you life, how you recreate yourself. What is play for you? Fourthly, pray. Love, work, play, pray. Usually when I say pray, I get this glanced look. Oh, God, what does that mean? Are we going to pray here? I say, wait a minute, we're not going to pray in this room. Although there have been one or two occasions where someone was explicit about wanting to do that, and I allowed for it to happen. I thought, this is what we need to do. I say, pray may be religion. It may be formal prayer. It may be a kind of spiritual practice. Maybe you're Buddhist. Maybe you use mindfulness meditation, that as your pray. I said, it could be the core values you live by, which you make very conscious in your mind. It could be thinking about what's really important to you in your life. It may be a philosophy of life. It may be a particular spiritual practice. I said, all of those are fair game in here. We can talk about those. I invite that in because what's becoming clear is that religion and spirituality, while they can be adverse, and believe me, in my own life experience, I had aversive experiences of religion not helping me to grow or mature psychologically or personally, but the same way they also can. There's a wonderful book called Religion and Coping, and it talks about that. So I invite that in right there at the beginning. And then we get to work, and I listen for it. I listen for it. And I respond to it. Remember I was telling you the four steps of listening? Listen, hear, then react or respond. If you're not comfortable with your spirituality or religion, or not comfortable with the concepts even, you're going to react. But you need to shift that into a response, something that you are in control of. So first react, then respond. So response. And then finally, the fourth step of listening is resting in it. Sometimes we just need to rest in what a person has come to realize through his or her asking the right questions, you helping and collaborating with them to do so as they work their way through to that answer. So you just rest in that moment and let them savor it. It's like having had a good meal with friends. But you just sit there and you look around the table and you look at what was prepared and it's no longer on the plate, but it's consumed, or the beverage you've had, and you just savor it. And I think a lot of what I do in therapy is hopefully moving toward that point where people can work through the good and the bad and get to a point of savoring. So I wanted to, that's a taste of how I work.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful description, and it's hard to respond at the moment because I wanted to savor really some of what you've said. So, but it's really, I really like the idea of just what you're saying makes a lot of sense, and how it could be applied to people in different professions as well as in life. And it just resonates a lot with me. I did want to ask this other question before we move on to other areas too, which takes us a little bit back to what you were saying before, but Marcia from LA had a question, and basically you had commented on the overarching way that Christianity works and sort of Buddhism, and she wondered if you could sort of talk a little about the arc of Judaism. And she said she from her perspective, the overarching searches for justice, and on a personal level, she said she's trying to figure out whether to go to synagogue tonight. Tonight's the beginning of Yom Kippur, which is the most devout of the Jewish holidays, the time of confessing sins, basically, and atoning for them. And she says she's just trying to figure out about the organized religious part of it because she rarely finds the spirituality. And you, in a way, commented a little on that religion doesn't necessarily do it for a lot of people. But right. I wondered if you could talk a little about that overarching part about Judaism, too, and maybe respond to Marcia's question.
I can try. Let me put a disclaimer out there. I said earlier, I'm an expert because I'm willing to say what I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs of Judaism. I do have some sense, and certainly my roots as a Christian are very much in Judaism. It's part of, it's in my blood too. I'm not Jewish, but I have been heavily influenced by Jewish faith and traditions. justice. If justice is the issue, what is the problem? Right? It's that people aren't just. We all have, in Christianity, and I don't know, I ran across this, there's a book called The Seven Deadly Sins. Might be interesting for you to pick up a copy of that, Shlomo Schimmel. And what he does is he looks at the seven deadly sins in ancient civilization, in Judaism, and in Christianity. And it's really those predispositions in us as human beings. We have the capability of being magnanimous and broad-minded, but we also have the capacity to be petty and small-minded. If you think about pride, to run across an arrogant individual, you want to get out of his or her company as quickly as you can. But there's also a good side to pride, right? Pride is, I know, I believe I am good. Is there anything arrogant about saying, I believe I'm a lovable, worthwhile individual? Though many of us on this call even might have in the past or still do or will continue to wrestle with, can I boast or brag? I'm not talking about boasting or bragging. I'm just saying I am lovable. I've come to believe that in an essential kind of way. Avariciousness or greed, right? The injustice that's been done, given our current economic situation, particularly because of avariciousness and greed, one of the seven deadly sins. How to transform, and I think that's the key word, not to deny that you don't have it in you, because all of us also have it in us to be unjust, but how to transform the unjust into the just, to transform the greed into generosity, the transformation of pride into healthy self-esteem or self-respect. I would say that the problem, the solution, and the technique is, in therapy, for example, and I think this would be the case in spiritual direction also, it's to own those parts. What I will often see in group is people disowning the parts in themselves that they hate and discharging them onto someone else, whatever that might be. It's called scapegoating. In psychological terms, projective identification. Moments like that are opportunities. They're spiritual as well as psychological opportunities. A chance to take that which you don't like and see that it's also part of me. I'm not always what I'd like to be. And I've got to own that, put it together with that which I am and like to be, and let them meld together, to mix them together, so that I'm fully, in Christianity, I'm not sure what the term would be in Judaism, but in Christianity, the term was, I am both saint and sinner. Both, not either or, both. So maybe in working toward justice, the problem is, as it is in all traditions, what we could call the seven deadly sins, and transforming those and looking at examples of people who have that, the saints in the Christian tradition, the rabbis, the great rabbis in the Jewish tradition, the lamas in the Buddhist tradition, people who have owned their full humanity. And I think that's crucial. It's spirituality is not about fleeing your humanity. In fact, it's about entering very deeply into it. And what I try to encourage as a psychologist is people entering deeply into and accepting their humanity. There was a Jesuit who wrote several books in the early 60s, and one was called Christ and Apollo, and he talked about the proclivity in all of us to flee, to get away from the finite, to flee to the infinite, the transcendent, to bypass what we are as human beings. And he said the only way to get there, ultimately, is by deeply passing in and through what he called the generative finite. It is finitude that generates the possibility for something more than, not by escaping it. It may be a little philosophical for this time of day, especially if you're in the morning in California, I don't know. But be willing to be the human being you are and not run and hide in shame. And I tell people in therapy, I've written several papers on shame. Shame is our greatest enemy. It does very well in the darkness. You bring it out into the light, that about which you're ashamed, and it dissipates. Mm-hmm. And that applies for spiritual as well as psychological.
Mm. That's a great point. And allowing one's own vulnerability and really confronting some of the fears in relation to that. It's so easy to not want to own that and project it onto other people, but just recognizing some of those fears, which leads to, I'm just also aware of the time, but leading to going back to Gauguin's painting and sort of the where are we going, somehow it feels like this is somehow related, that as we age, how or do you find that our relationship to religion and spirituality tends to change? I know for myself and many clients that I work with that there is this tendency of turning more inward, trying to just figure out the meaning, as you were saying before. But I wonder if you could speak to that and what your experience is of just how does the relationship change as we age?
Yeah. No, I think it definitely becomes, we both develop the potential to benefit from it, I think, or to grow through it, to grow through becoming more religious and spiritual. But again, I'm very aware when I speak about this topic, people think, oh, is he trying to proselytize or convert people? No, I'm just talking what means something to me. I have a colleague who gave me so much flack about offering a group, a demonstration group at one of our group therapy conferences on is there a place for spirituality in group therapy? And he gave me so much flack about that. And he said, I'm an atheist. And I said, I guess I didn't know, but I do now. Anyway, he kept haranguing me, and even at the conference, he gave me a hard time. And a month later, we happened to be dear friends, and friends, like dear, probably overstatement, but friends, yes. He said after the conference, he said, thank you. I said, for what? He said, for doing what you did. I said, what's that? He said, oh, bringing that into our professional society. I said, oh. He said, and I discovered something. I said, what's that? He said, I'm not an atheist. I'm an agnostic. That was not my goal. He comes out, and this is what he says. This is how it grows him. Again, not because I wanted it to, but because it went to his question. It helped him refashion his questions and led to a new answer. But I may have diverted from your question, Dori. A little bit in that digression.
Maybe just expand a bit more of just how it changes as we age.
Yeah. I think it becomes more urgent. I think James Hollis put this very well in one of his books. James Hollis is a Jungian analyst, lives in Texas. Worth reading. I think this book is cited in the recommended readings. He said, the second half of life presents a rich possibility for spiritual enlargement. For we are never going to have greater powers of choice, never have more lessons of history from which to learn, that is our own history, and never possess more emotional resilience, more insight into what works for us and what does not, or a deeper, sometimes more desperate conviction of the importance of getting our life back. Of getting our life back. We have a chance at this point in life to get our life back. And the way to do that, I think, is to realize that getting older is a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call. One of the things that may wake us up to has been put this way. Many people have never taken any risks, never moved outside their comfort zone, never faced necessary suffering, and so their unconscious knows that they have never lived. Or loved. That's called waking up. So ask yourself, what's waking you up in your older age? That's one of those four points of spirituality in the handout, that it's first of all being awake. Secondly, it's getting rid of illusions about life, about others, about yourself, maybe most importantly. getting rid of those illusions. And in fact, in the second half of life, you may be in a better position to shed the illusions and deal with the disillusionment about others, life, and especially yourself. Because you come to expect in the second half of life various forms of half-heartedness, deceit, vanity, or illusions from yourself. But now you see through them. You can't lie to yourself when you get to be 66. You could lie to yourself when you're 18, maybe any age younger. But now, as you get older, you can't lie. But when you see through them, the power is gone. They don't have control over you. And that's the third point of spirituality. It's never being at the mercy of any event, thing, or person. Now, those of you who know about or even do or have been patients or clients in cognitive behavioral therapy know how much our lives are run by our thoughts and how much we're at the mercy of events, things, or people, but even more at the mercy of the thoughts we have about those events, things, or people. So spirituality and good psychotherapy are about reducing being at the mercy of any of those things.
Mm. It sounds like it's so much more tied into than, as you were saying before, the being authentic nature, being responsible for ourselves and our own personal authority, rather than feeling such a victim to outside parts.
It is about becoming more self-possessed in one sense, but also thereby more free to let go. People might want to ask themselves, what is it I'm at the mercy of? And are you at the mercy of a bad self-image? The fourth point of spirituality is having found the diamond mine inside yourself. Do you really appreciate how remarkable you are? And I can hear voices saying, yeah, if you really knew me, and that's what often happens in therapy or in groups, if you really knew me. And so people hide, they're ashamed, they conceal, and it's only when they come forth that we begin to appreciate how unique they are. But again, don't let it go to your head, folks. There's nothing unique about uniqueness. Just appreciate that everyone is.
Right.
Here's what I would recommend for people. The readings, check that list over. There are some excellent readings there to get you further immersed. Also, practices. What one practice would I recommend? Interestingly enough, the longitudinal study that was headed by George Valiant here at Harvard University on aging, and there's the book Aging, which I cite in that list also. He said there are a lot of things that are essential for aging well. But the most important thing, this appeared in an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe, 2001, just before the book came out. The most important things are gratitude and forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So learn to practice gratitude and learn to practice forgiveness. And I believe they cantilever with each other, so that if you build up your gratitude, you're going to be more forgiving. You know those people that you don't even know why you hate them anymore? Where you have relatives who hate a relative, they don't even remember what happened that led to it. If you're grateful, you got more room to let go and forgive. And if you're more forgiving, you will see how fortunate you are to be living the life you're living. Irving Berlin put it very well in one of his songs. People probably know, maybe, I assume this audience, many people know who Irving Berlin was. But he went through a crisis period when he was at the height of his powers, successful. Everybody knew Irving, except he was depressed, despondent. He went to get medicines from his physician. They didn't help. He went to see a psychoanalyst. That didn't help. And then he discovered something that helped, and he wrote a song about it. And it goes like this. When I'm worried and I can't sleep, I count my blessings instead of sheep. And I fall asleep counting my blessings. That song came out of a profound psychological and spiritual experience for Irving Berlin. Probably not appreciated because this backstory is not known. But my hope is that you can read some of the books that are there, if nothing else, every day when you go to bed at night.
That's great. And would you like people to just email you directly for these tests?
What's your custom? People sometimes get wary of emailing. They figure I'm going to get barraged.
The other alternative is if you want to send it to me, I can have it posted so that those people who've signed up will have access to the articles you're talking
about.
Let's do that
to begin with. Yes, I'm happy for people to contact me. And if you want to pursue a conversation in some way or I can be of use to you, let me know. But let's do it that way.
Okay.
Those who prefer not to get on someone else's email list won't fear that is what's going to happen.
Okay. No, that sounds good. And I must say, this has been wonderful. There was one, I know we're just about out of time, but just in the forward future looking, there was one question from Bill in Cambridge, just wondering what models are evolving to connect people. He says one in three households now consist of just one person. And he wonders what models are evolving to connect people who are living alone during the second half of life and they really hunger for spiritual connect. And so he, as a fellow aging baby boomer, wonders what dreams you might have for responding to that kind of demographic trend of people hungering for the spiritual connect but living alone.
I find some of that at my parish at times. I've got a peer group in my professional organization that I reach out to. I make sure I get together with my friends. I haven't used any of the formal ways. I haven't used the senior center, but I don't know how old Bill is. We tend to eschew those things because that says I'm old.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the first step is just accepting where you are and looking for a peer group who's willing to talk with you about things as you wish to talk about them. And I have found that within one of my professional peer groups.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying be creative and allow yourself
to be creative. There's a program in Cambridge called Cambridge at Home. And I know that they do, that may be a way to go, Cambridge at Home.
Oh, that's great.
And then there's also the Somerville Cambridge Elder Services, which is a wonderful organization. They may, again, I don't know, they may be a resource as well.
Mm, that's great. And probably there are even things like adult education programs often have programs and all around spirituality and philosophy and what's the meaning of life. So there's so many different ways that people can connect.
Exactly. There is a Harvard program that is, they vet people, but you can get into programs with older folks. By older, I'm probably 60 plus, 55 plus. There's also Tali and Bali, I call them. Tufts.
Yeah, the Osher. Lifelong learning.
Lifelong, Osher, look up Osher Lifelong Learning, Osher, Lifelong Learning, and find one that's local in your vicinity.
And in addition, just to add, in addition to the Osher programs, if wherever you live, if you Google Lifelong Learning, there are other places that aren't affiliated with Osher, but they have wonderful programs. There's some that are OSHA related here in Boston, where I live, and the environs, but there are also some here that are separate from that. But it's a wonderful way to connect with people around shared interests. And I am aware of the time, Bob. This was wonderful. Thank you so much for, and
You're
I think
welcome.
Using Gauguin's painting and really sharing your own life and experiences from your past, present and future is just a wonderful way, I think, for all of us, as you were saying too, to just do the reflecting and thinking and opening ourselves to the questions, really, to the questions of finding meaning in life. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing with us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Take care.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.